Good afternoon. My name's Sharon Crane. I'm an alcoholic. I got a lot of bottles and cans up here. It's good. Makes me feel right at home. Thank you, Bob, for the invite. And thank you, Kim, for hosting. And I've got a lot of women here that I know and love, and one particular man that I know and love, and a few other, but not in the biblical sense, my husband, Casey. I'm glad he's here with me. It's interesting that it's been talked about a lot of self-will, self-directing, running the show, and I must say that I would not be here at all if it wasn't for a loving God and for sponsorship. Sponsorship has been extremely important in my sobriety, my 33 years, and Clancy, who is my sponsor now, just told me if I'm doing good, I can mention him, and if I'm not, talk about my second sponsor a lot, so, but I won't blow his cover. We'll have to wait and see how I'm doing. I love 8 and 9, and I love everybody that has brought me to this point, most of whom are sitting over there, of opening up our minds and our hearts. And one of my favorite parts of the book is the and there's a solution, and it's kind of where we've just been, and it's it just makes me feel so hopeful. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And I am not up here by myself. I am up here as an amazing culmination of a spirit that has been transformed with a lot of help and a lot of prayers of people who love me and people who probably resented me, but they still had to pray for me. And I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, not by myself. And I want to always remember that God is, and God, my second sponsor, Jenny, there I'll talk about her, Clancy, wrote me a note once. I was going home, actually, to do some more amends. And she wrote me a note, and I was afraid to fly. And I remember she said, go talk to Clancy, because he was her sponsor at the meeting. He flies all the time. I mean, I flew all the time drinking. But now I'm sober, and I'm like, just really have this huge fear of flying. And so I went and talked to Clancy at the meeting. I said, Ginny said I need to talk to you because I'm afraid to fly. He said, don't watch the wings. Don't watch the wings. So I'm on one of those night flights where the wings, we're in a storm, so I can see the wings. I don't want to see the wings, but I'm sitting by the wings. And, you know, they're doing this all night. You know, they're moving too much. And so I'm just like, okay, Clancy says, don't watch the wings. But, you know, I'm looking through my hands at the wings. And I landed, and I had a successful amends process. But, you know, that's what she wrote me, that note. God either is or he isn't, and if he isn't, we're all dead anyway. I was like, okay, got it. Too many clothes, and I'm on a stage, and Gail, whatever. Wrap it around your pole. It's become Gail's pole now, you know. But, the hearts that have been opened this weekend, and the 8 a.m. with Peggy and Steve last night with keeping his composure with everything going on, and Gail, I love her passion for the archives, and I just got so much out of your talk, Don. You just brought me right into the black and white of the book and right into the love of God, and and I know there's so much more to come, and I'm just kind of a filler in between all of that and Clancy tonight and Mike and Carl tomorrow morning. So I'm just here to do my job. And amends are one of my absolute favorites. And there's 8 pages of instructions in the book, and it's pretty specific. And it talks about a couple of times what Kim talked about, that we've, it says it twice in there. Okay, we made this pact You know, it's like I always, every time I see it, I think, okay, I made a pact with God, not with the devil, that I would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And it says it a couple of times. In these 8 specific pages of how to make amends when, you know, it has a lot to do with other people and if it'll affect them, that is the amends going to hurt them? It's got a lot of specifics. It talks about the tornado. Love the tornado. It talks about, you know, my real purpose, which is I'm a blackout drinker. So when I saw that on page 77, that my real purpose is to fit myself, to be of maximum service to God and the people about me, it gave me some peace. You know, I came in here with a bag of rocks, and then we unearthed more, as Don talked about, and then I put more rocks in my bag. And I remember a man named Chuck Nesbitt looked at me when I was really new with my broken jaw, and I'm wired up. I can't talk the first 3 months I'm in AA. I, too, didn't look at anybody. I couldn't speak. I couldn't eat. I wasn't a lot of fun to hang around. I drooled. And this man, Chuck, walked up to me, and I had a backpack. It had a book in it called Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass. Like, I knew a lot about being here now, but I was, you know, it's my book. And I'm a runner, and I don't stay anywhere long enough for any consequences, but I'm in AA now, and I'm tired. And this man walked up to me, Chuck Nesbitt, he said, "You look tired, kid." I thought, how does he know? How does he know? He said, "You look tired. Take off your pack and stay with us a while." And he walked away, and then he came back, and he must have thought about it for just a second. He said, "No, you look really tired." And he invited me to stay longer than 30 days. I think he said, "Stay with us for 30 days the first time," and then he came back and he said, "Stay with us for 90 days or something." And so I thought, okay, he knows I'm tired, and he just invited me here to stay with you. So I came in here with an obvious pack of rocks on me. I couldn't even lift my body up straight. I was, I had been victimized. I was in, I had to go to court. My jaw had been broken. My nose had been broken. I had a tooth kicked out. I was sucking on red wine through the wires on the jaw where the tooth had been when I woke up on August 20th of 1975, and the guy that I was staying with said to me, "You got to leave. You're depressing me." And I was like, it wasn't really what you wanted to hear from a drinking buddy. And so I called my mother, my mom, who has 4 children. And much like you, Ron, I'm the middle child, and I have my hero sister. I have my nurse, Sally, who wanted to be a nurse when she was 4, and that's what she did, and moved to Alaska, and she's still there. Then I have my brother who carried the family name, and I was that middle child. I am the only alcoholic in my family. I'm still the only alcoholic in my family. And there were many, many, many nights my mother did not sleep at night because Alcoholics Anonymous now has given her the nights of sleep, and I thank you for that. And, you know, they say that in much of the amends stuff, it's because it's so much not about me, and I thought it was. They say that when an alcoholic goes out the door, that immediately, and these are people that are pretty new, because once you stick around a while, you have, you know, your life touches a lot of other lives. But immediately, 10 people are affected. Immediately. So if you're kind of new in here and in your first year and you think that going and taking a drink is not going to affect anyone, there's 10 people that are exhaling tonight because they know you're sitting in AA. There's 10 people that will sleep at night because they know you're here. There's 10 people that might digest their dinner because they know you're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and that you are safe. So it is not about you if you're new or newer. Now you can go back to thinking about yourself, which is your favorite person. But I called my mother that morning, and she had had a couple of sleepless nights not knowing what shape her daughter was in, because she had gotten a call from that hospital in Palm Springs that I had been beaten up and abused and drug around and was just in bad shape and intensive care. And they didn't tell her what hospital I was in. They just said it was California. So my mother in Iowa and my sister in New York called all these hospitals, and for 2 days until they found me, my mother did not know how her daughter was. So when I called my mom on August 20th that morning, and it was 3 weeks before that she wasn't sleeping at night worrying about her daughter, not knowing what shape she was in. You would think, because I'm a parent, you would jump, okay, come home, I'll send you an airline ticket. She said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore, go to the Salvation Army. And I so want to be grateful for that moment, for my mother saying no, because of, as Norma Alpe talked about, the seconds and inches that each one of us have the privilege of being here. That was a second there. If she would have said $20 and then don't call home anymore. So my mother had been very much involved in my alcoholism, whether she was watching me or not. She was very much in love with her daughter and very much worried about her daughter. So that my mother sleeps at night, that is a continual amend that I get to make by being sober in the room with Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I ended up with you. I woke up a drinker and I ended up with you that night, and I have not had a drink or a toke or a head of acid or any of that other fun stuff that was out there in the 60s, because it wasn't just say no, it was just say thanks. And that's a moment of grace. And we each have had that moment of grace. And the central fact that I have, that central fact, it is indeed miraculous. And I do know that. So the amends step is something that after I finally did my inventory with a woman named Janet, and I finally did my fifth step, because it seemed like in my group there was peer pressure to have your inventory done by the time you blew out that candle on your first cake. And I think peer pressure can be kind of good sometimes. There was a woman in that was newer than me that came in 8 days after me named Pat, who many of you know. She spoke here last year. And Pat came in 8 days after me in Alcoholics Anonymous, stole my thunder, if I had any, because I was the drooling, couldn't-talk newcomer. So it didn't seem like the old-timers were hanging out with me too much. But the old-timers just gravitated towards Pat. So I was a little resentful of Pat. And she seemed to have gone through her steps much quicker than I was going through my steps. And it seemed to me that, you know, they would read steps 4 and 5, and she would turn around and look at me like, I'm in my amends. You haven't even done yours yet. You know, that was the look, it seemed to me, she was giving me at the meeting when they would read the steps. So I thought, you know, I went through a lot of struggle, but I ended up finishing my fifth step with Janet. And I was ready that night. It was right before I turned one, and I was going to turn one 8 days before Pat, believe me. I didn't want to give up those 8 days. There were times, and I thought, I can't have less time than her. I'll just stick it out tonight, you know. I'll just stay one more night because I don't want to have less time than the one who had done all the steps so perfectly. So I finally did my fifth step, and I was waiting for her that night to turn around because she was going to look at me, and I know she was. See, she had a husband dying of cancer, and they wanted her to start living amends with him. They wanted her to hurry up and get through. I didn't know any of that. I just thought she cried a lot, got a lot of attention, and was better than me. And, you know, my perception is she judged me. And so she turned around and looked that night, but someone had told her that Sharon finally did her fifth step. You know, she's going to be one on Thursday, but she finally did her fifth step, and she gave me the biggest smile. And I didn't want to like her, but I started to like her. And the joy of that is that Pat and I still celebrate our birthdays every August. Me, August 20th. Her, August 28th. every year. But Pat's peer pressure, you know, it's just there was something about it. I had to get that inventory done. I had to, you know, I had no defects of character. It was kind of like it was the half a page in the book. That was kind of as quickly as we ran through it, me and Janet. It seemed like, I don't know if she knew much about it, but, you know, okay, well, I'm angry sometimes. You know, it was really just very cursory and not very deep, and I was really out of it for a while. I was really not firing on all my circuits for a while. It took a while to put this back together, this human being, you know, step by step by step. And Janet had had me make my list from my fourth step. So I made this big, long list, and it included everybody that I owed amends to and that owed amends to me. You know, everybody that I hurt and that everybody that hurt me. You know, I thought, well, I'm going to go talk to them, you know. So I was pretty innocent about all that, and I remember Janet taking the list and starting to cross people out. It was like, she said, Sharon, you're not a victim anymore. You know, it talks about in there that, we don't go scraping in front of anybody. And it uses that word and that terminology. And so I was like, okay. But the biggest one she said I needed to start with was my family. And I was, biggest one on my list, my father. And I was, I risked playing the accordion. My father's Czech, and the accordion was not cool back in the 60s. Sometimes it's maybe still not cool now, but, I was the little girl that could paint the pictures that were hanging in the restaurants in the little town in Iowa that I grew up in, and we would walk down the street and look at the paintings Sharon had done in the restaurants. And so Daddy, I wanted to make him proud, and he had the Mensa first daughter, who saved my life when I was 9 in a fire. So how do you compete? You just can't, you can't, so you hate her, she read every, those little things that came out? She read every book. She would order every book on those little papers that came out as she grew up. Her whole, under her bed was full of books. So I thought, well, she's reading and I'll never read. And it's like, okay, so I start reading the classics in sobriety because I've not read. And I love reading now, but it was like, I'm not going to be like her. And so Nancy was that one. And my dad had that relationship with her that was special. And so I wanted something. So I painted the pictures and I played the accordion. I remember I was up for Miss Eastern Iowa. I know. So... And I know you couldn't sleep your way to the top with that one either, I'll tell you. They were all Shriners, drunk, and anyway. So I was in this, convertible, in this, I remember I had this white pique cotton with navy accents dress, and my hair was just, you go to the hairdresser, I want to look like this, and, never does, but... So I'm trying to comb it out, and they gave me roses. I had roses, and I had gloves on, and my Miss Mount Vernon sash, and I'm in the Miss Eastern Iowa contest, and my dad was so proud of me, so proud of me. I mean, he stood there with his buddies in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, as the cars come around, and, and they're all, cheered when I came by, and I was so hung over. I was so hungover. Even in the picture, you can see the dark circles I was trying to cover up. So he was still hoping, as I was that age. But things were starting to turn, and my father got to know way too much about me, and my father got to know way too much about my life, and my father would ask me what was wrong, and I would tell him. I would tell him things that you shouldn't tell your father. And my father and I stopped speaking. My father and I stopped having breakfast at the same table. My father and I stopped communicating. My mother said at one point when I came back in my trials to live at home and recuperate a little bit, she said, you can stay here, but you upset your father. Please don't get in his way. I was the thing that lived upstairs. So I stayed out of my dad's way, and we didn't look at each other, and we had no communication after I was about 18 and a half years old. And he tried to help, and he got close to me. And every time he got close to me, I would hurt him again. And he just stopped trying. So my dad and I had no relationship. And it affected my relationship with men, not having that healed with my father. And I didn't know that until the amends process was through and the innocence came back. Something I didn't expect from the amends process with my father. But I got on that plane, I watched the wings, I didn't watch the wings, whatever I had to do, and I went home, and I had to make those amends to my father. He was first on my list. I talked to my mother and I are fine, we've always been fine. My mother and I have this heart-to-heart bond that just seems to can't be broken. It's very, very tight. And we're almost of the same heart at times, my mom and I. And that went very, very well. And my father, it didn't go so well. I was afraid of him. I was afraid of talking to him. I was afraid of disappointing him. I'm the alcoholic. They don't know what to think. She's an AA. They didn't understand it. I remember my mother said, she told me later that my grandmother said, Sharon looks really good. What's going on with her? And my mother said, the aunt even whispered, she's an AA. You know, it's like nobody in the family could say it. So talk about being an example. I mean, I'm the only one that they've seen. And so I go home and I'm having a pretty good time. And I hadn't, you know, my dad and I were not eye contact. We're not really riding in the car alone together yet because God knows we might start having a talk about, you know, politics or the 60s or what I did or that guy or something. Or the money or something. And I just, I thought, you know, we're putting my bags in the trunk. I'm going back to Los Angeles. I've been here for 10 days. My sponsor sent me on this trip explicitly to make amends to my mother and father. And I haven't done it yet. And I said, I better do it now, or if I get off that plane, she will put me back on the plane, and she will kill me if I don't get it done. So having a sponsor louder than your head when you're new is really important. And so my dad's putting the bags in the trunk, and I say, I need to talk to you. And, you know, he's okay. And I can still feel this moment. It was an incredibly powerful moment for me because I was trying to come clean. And boy, I lived a life of the carnival, the French Quarter, I mean, hitchhiking. I lived a life that you don't come clean. I don't drink in the bars where they say, how are you? And I say, well, I think I want to come clean with you today. Or, you know, I'm having this kind of emotion. Let's talk about it. You know, nobody talked. We had aliases. Nobody cared. Who's buying? That's what we cared about. And so I'm trying to come clean with my father, and we lay against the car. He's leaning. I'm leaning. The car is parked on sand. I remember it was an Indian summer day. It was warm. The sun was on my shoulders. The back of the car was warm on my back. And we made holes in the sand with our toes. And nobody looked at each other. We were looking down. And I was making a hole in the sand with my toe talking, and then he was making a hole in the sand talking. And I said my little scripted amends to my father, which was short and sweet in about two sentences. And, you know, I don't even think I knew enough then to say anything except, you know, I'm sorry and what can I do at the end. I didn't even know how to say, how can I make it right? I didn't know how to do that. And he said, I just always wanted you to be happy. It was it. That was it. And the sponsor, I got off the plane, she said, did you do it? And I said, yeah. She said, good, it's a start. Start. It's a start. So Janet had me go through this list. And, you know, I had a lot of, boy, the light's not very good up here. I had a lot of moments with my list with her that have come to fruition that I never thought would. And one of them totally being New Orleans. And I had been involved in Mardi Gras, my last Mardi Gras out there drinking. I had been involved with a friend of mine as a friend. We were buddies. He was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's. He was a good guy. We partied a lot together. We partied that night. I was at the end of, I got sober in August. That was in March. I was really bloated, toxic, alcoholic mess, gallbladder gone, pancreatitis, working in a seedy Lower Decatur Street bar where you could smell the bathroom as you walked in. Even my alcoholic friends didn't want to hang with me anymore. And Michael was one of my buddies. And he, when he would get off Pat O'Brien's, we would party. And we Mardi Gras that Mardi Gras night, the night before, and Mardi Gras day, and he had a gun, and I just kind of remember I was in the brownout, and I remember being on Bourbon Street, and he was pointing the gun at somebody because he didn't like their costume. And this was so out of character for my friend. And I just said, oh, come on, Michael, it's Mardi Gras day. Put your gun away. You know, that's how my reality was. And we ended up at where I was staying, sleeping on my friend Danny's couch. And there was a party, and I guess we went out for wine, and he was shooting at people off the balcony, and the police were called. And I was the last person to talk to him alive. I closed the door, and the next thing I remember, the shots were fired, and everybody hit the deck, and my friend Michael, I didn't open the door. I went and took a bath. I said, I'm taking a bath. Everybody hit the deck. That was my reality. I couldn't even look. I'm taking a bath, and I made the police break down the door. So this is my friend, who I don't know if he's dead or dying outside my door. I am the last person to talk to him alive. I'm interrogated by New Orleans police all Mardi Gras day as the floats are going by down there. I'm drunk. They're saying horrible things about me. My friend who was on the force came and read me the report, and he said, you better get out of town. We found some stuff. I was already a convicted felon. It was hard timing. Angola, get out of town. And by the way, your friend Michael is dead. And I was the last one to talk to him alive. I don't know what I said. I don't know if I had anything to do with it. I'm a blackout drinker. So that was on my list. My friends in New Orleans that I had cheated, the ones that I had hurt, the ones that we had done very not very nice things to each other as women, they were all on my list. And I had no idea how all of this New Orleans stuff was going to play out, because I was afraid to go back there. I want to know the truth. And guess what was 1980, where the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous was? In New Orleans. And I was like, what? We're going to go to that drinking town and have a sober get together. And our group, we save money and we go. We'd have kind of a bank account and we put money in for years, and then we get the plane tickets and we get to go. So I did that. And we went down to New Orleans as a group. And I'm on the plane. I know it's Alabama on the plane. Clancy was on the plane. I mean, I thought, okay, I'm all right today, you know. But then I'm thinking, this is my alcoholic thinking. Then if we go down, they're not going to know me because Clancy's going to be on the plane. Alabama's going to be on the plane. I'll just be one of the passengers, you know. So, yeah, how we think, right? Right? So we get to New Orleans, and I kind of take them on a field trip. And we went back to the scene of the crime, very many different places. Clancy and the bunch, we all went to this place called Buster Holmes, and we begged them to let us in. And I got behind the bar, and I put out root beers for everybody. And Clancy, we all say Mickey Mouse for him. That was the place I would go. I could get red beans and rice, real French bread and butter for 95 cents, and I would eat there a lot. And they brought out their best for us. And I went out that night, and I saw my old roommate, the one I was sleeping on her couch, and my friend Michael was killed. She didn't recognize me. Just how you had cleaned me up in Alcoholics Anonymous at almost 5 years of sobriety spoke volumes. I didn't have to say a word. And I stood in front of her and told her who I was, and she was blown away. We were staying at the Hyatt Hotel, where my other friend, Robin, who was one of my other good friends, was a cocktail waitress. So she came up to my room to see me drunk as a skunk. She laid on my bed. I remember her cocktail waitress uniform. I had to kind of snap it up for her. It was like coming open, and she's got the big book. I wish I would have had a camera. She's coming out of her little cocktail thing. She's got the big book. She's passed out. She doesn't remember coming to see me at all. And Denny is sober in January, 25 years. Robin is sober 25 years in Boston, and I'm her sponsor. And they weren't ready that day, but just being an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to go back to New Orleans a few years later, and Denny introduced me to the man who lived downstairs of the apartment where I stayed on her couch, and that Mardi Gras thing happened with my friend Michael being killed. And the man was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sat and talked to me because he heard everything that happened that morning. And I found out that I had nothing to do with him pulling the gun on the cop who killed him. I had nothing to do with kicking him out. I had nothing to do with it. And it was an amazing piece of freedom that came from being willing. It talks about willingness is all over these 8 pages. I was willing to face it. I was willing to do what I had to do. And by being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to have that healing happen. The circle got to close. And another beautiful thing about that is Denny went back to law school, and one day for fun and for free, because I was very embarrassed about being a felon. She went, researched, found out, got me in a general pardon from the state of Louisiana of people who were one-time offenders, and sent me that piece of paper in the mail that freed me. So talk about knowing a new freedom and a new happiness. That definitely was a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to go home and be with my family on my sister's wedding. And Ginny, a woman named Ginny, became my sponsor at about 5. And she was terrific. She softened me up and taught me how to be a woman. And one day I called her and I said, I was talking about my husband because he was being mean to me that day. And so I called her and started to whine. And she said, Sharon, I think it's time you call your father and ask him if you can start making financial amends. And I was like, no, we're talking about something, you know, my husband being mean. I want to whine a minute, but she was, you know, I don't know, I think they go to sponsor school or something happens, and they're ready there by the phone with a checklist, and it doesn't matter if you call and you're, you know, you broke your leg. I think it's time you go call and make financial amends, because it's next on the checklist. And so I kind of argued, but, you know, only quietly through the phone. I said, okay, I'll call him. And my father had been and walked me down the aisle when I was 2.5 years sober to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous and gave me away. My father had gone to the Pacific Group with me and met all of you and liked you. My father, somebody gave him the book, you know, literature, took it home and read it because that's how he is. And there's a moment that I never want to forget because I found this photograph only a few years ago, and it was my wedding day, and it was my father talking to me. It was at the end of my wedding because I was having a Peggy Lee moment. Is that all there is to a wedding, you know? Everybody's leaving. I want everybody to stay. We're having a good time. And I was like this with my chin on my hand and my wedding garb, and my father was right here. And we were eye to eye in that photograph, and it had been years. And I just found that photograph a few years ago. And I remember what he said to me that day. He said, Sharon, look at your life. If you think about doing what you were doing before, think twice because you've got it made. He was beginning to see the results of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he liked all of you. So when I called my father, Ginny had me call him at around 5 years of sobriety and ask him if I could make amends. He said, sure. He had read the book. On page 78, it says, most alcoholics owe money. And he put the calculator tape, my father, the Capricorn, on that page. And he had worked on my dossier and figured it out. And my brother said my dossier was about 3 inches thick. He said he saw it once in the office. It was pretty thick. So my father's, you know, he's an accounting kind of head, and he kept track of everything. So he worked it out. And when I called that day and he had a total for me, I was shocked. I was, what? And then the second thought was, it's too high. You know, it's like, because you know how we are. And so I called her back and I said, oh my God, it's this much. And so she's, you know, let me rant a little bit. And he was ready for me. And you know, my mother said that he's told her, too, if I called and I stay sober long enough and get to this part of the book, I will call. And if I'm not home, would you please give her this figure here? And she said it was circled in red. It was circled in red. So I get a new resentment, you know, just keep those sponsors busy. And so she said, all right, call him back in 2 days and see if he'll accept your payment terms. Well, I thought, okay, that's right. I didn't go to Europe like the rest of the children. They all graduated from college, and he bought them a trip to Europe. Oh, that's right, I didn't graduate from college. Let's see. He bought them all a car, too. Oh, that's right, I took two. I kept thinking he might amend it a little bit. I was hopeful when I made that call in 2 days, and he said he accepted my terms. He didn't say, oh, gee, I've been thinking about it. I know it's a little high, you know. I know you're working hard. You're sponsoring people. You're trying to be of service. No, he just said, okay. And he accepted my payment terms. That was like, I called Janie right back. I said, oh, my God, he accepted my terms. She said, good. Then without fail, because you may be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous your father ever sees, I don't know about you. I know it's Bill's birthday here. But there's something that makes my spine straighten when somebody says, you may be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous that person will ever see. There's no way I can do it justice, but I want to try to do my best. I want to shine up my cheeks and shine up my shoes and straighten on up and press my clothes and be a good example. And so she used that line on me, and she got me. You know, she got me. She said, don't be late with that check. Do not be late with that check. And make sure that, you know, you send it on time so he gets it on time every month, every single month. And she said, one more thing, because you know sponsors want more for you than you want for them, for yourself. She wanted more for me than I wanted for myself. She said, are you willing to grow through this with your father? Because she didn't say, are you willing to heal? Are you willing to have a wonderful relationship? Are you willing to have the guilt go away? Because I would have said, that's not possible. She said, are you willing to grow through this? And that's been my process in Alcoholics Anonymous, is growth. And so I understood what she was saying, and I said, okay. You know, we had grown. We had grown into a better relationship as father and daughter. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't real emotional or comfortable yet, but we were growing towards something. So I said, okay. She said, then don't send that check alone in the mail. Put a note with it about your life. Do not send the cold, hard cash alone. And it was, he doesn't really care about my life, you know. So the first time I did it, she said she didn't care, do it anyway. I told him about some panel I had gone to at the women's prison, you know, thinking he's not going to want to hear from me again. But I'm such a little bit of a rebellion person, and I wrote about the panel I went. He was interested, you know. My dad was interested in my life, and he thought that, you know, he liked you people. My father was not an alcoholic, but I don't know, he seemed to have a lot of the ilk of the humor that we have. So he liked that I would share with him some of the fun things that I got to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in fact, so much so that he would walk down the street and blow my anonymity to people. I'd go back to class reunions and they go, God, you've been in AA how long now? You know, it's like, yeah, your dad was telling me all about you at coffee the other day. And I was like, okay. So my dad got a check and a note, a check and a card. I remember Father's Day wasn't so hard. You know, I remember I would stand over the card in my early sobriety, the Father's Day cards, and I would sweat. And I'm not a sweater, but I would literally have beads of sweat because that's so close, but it's not saying, oh yeah, that's too mushy, can't have, you know, I would sometimes walk away and not even get a Father's Day card. I would just give him a flower card and write something in it. But I seemed that as I was in this process of that check and that note or that check and that card, that the Father's Day thing got easier. It seemed like the trips home got a little more comfortable. We could talk about something in the newspaper or something on the news, or we could discuss a little bit more about my life. And I was in the middle of this process when I went home for my sister's wedding. Long segue. And they picked me up at the airport. I'm coming alone. It was on a night flight. I got stuck in Chicago. My neck was like this. I slept somewhere on the seat with the air conditioning blowing on me. It's early morning. They're all in the van. It's like they've already been there having a good time. They're fed, watered, and rested. You know what I mean? And they're picking me up early in the morning. I'm getting off the plane in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I get in the van, and it's like, hi, 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 hi. And then, okay, my sister's back with the same conversation with my father. It seemed like they just picked up 10 years ago talking about finance. He's even asking her opinion. And she's, you know, and he's listening to her. So number one sister's in the front with all of my dad's attention. Okay, so I look in the back, and there's my mom, and hi, Mom, hi. And she's talking to my sister, the bride-to-be, right, about, you know, the wedding dress or the gifts or something. And I'm thinking, well, you know what? I got married. I know a little bit about that. And, Dad, don't you remember? I'm giving you back the money I owe you, you know. I'm doing better now. And my brother is talking fishing with his new brother-in-law. And it's like, well, I know how to bait a hook. You know, I've even, you know, eaten the trout right from the stream. But nobody cares. They're like all in their stuff. And I'm sitting in the middle of the van. And before I know it, I'm having a cathartic sobbing. You know, and I make a noise. I realize, oh, my God, I'm making noise. And so we're on the Cedar River Road going home. It's a country road. My father stops the van, turns around and looks at me. And he said, are you okay? Oh, I've waited for this moment my whole life. And here I have the platform, and I get to be the victim again. I'm ready to go. And something, all the work that we had done up to that point, all of those being a good example, all of those trips home, all of what would he tell somebody you sponsor, you know, God is or he isn't. I heard a voice that said, get out of the van. Get out of the van. And I got out of the van, and I said, I just need some water. Well, they handed me water and went back to their conversations. It was like, oh. You know, nobody said, are you okay? God, we've always loved you. You're just so wonderful. You know, I appreciate everything you've done. I know that you all broke our hearts, but we're mending now. And, you know, it's like nothing. No, just gave me some water and went back to their conversations. And I thought for a moment there I could have blown all of that step work, all of that God that you've allowed me to bring into my family from my own heart, all of the good will that I bring home, the good actions. It could have gone in a second, because I go to that victim place sometimes. And I stood out of the van, and I'm an Iowa girl, and there was the corn there, and it was, I had a moment, you know, with God that it was going to be okay and there's a plan for me. And the corn is all laid out and it's all been thought out and it's fertilized so much, and some years you can plant on it, some years you can't. And there's life happening and it's a beautiful thing, raising corn. And I saw for a minute as I turned away that there's rows and there's a plan, and I too am included in God's plan. And I got back in, and I continued to make, we had a great weekend, I continued to make the financial amends to my father. I didn't blow it midstream. I didn't even put this together until much later in my life. And so I did that with my father, and there were times I didn't think I had the money. And having a sponsor, I mean, this step is so action-oriented that I got to keep my sponsor involved. I would call her and say, I don't think I have the money this month. And she said, you know what? Your dad doesn't need it, but he's putting it into a trust fund for you, so you'll probably get it back at the end of all this with interest. Oh, my God, trust fund. Okay, let's send it early then, you know? So I sent it early, and I remember I wrote the payment numbers in psychedelic colors in the memo line for a little bit, thinking he'll go, oh, my God, she's overpaying me, you know? Didn't matter. My dad got the check and the note and the check and the letter. I sat down. I wrote my dad a letter from top to bottom. Had turtles on the bottom. I didn't even realize that. I hadn't even thought about what I told him on a one-page letter, and I hadn't done that since I was a little girl in camp when I went to camp. And it had been that long that I didn't have to worry about communicating with this man that I loved as my father. And so my dad got this check and note, being a good example, showing up, going home, being happy, because that's what he asked for me. He wanted me to be happy. So I'm happy. And he picks up the phone and calls me between Christmas and New Year's. And now I'm, he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. You know, he dialed the phone. He dialed my number himself. Mother didn't hand him the line. It's usually a handoff, but Mom didn't hand. And he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. He said, I don't want your checks anymore. And, you know, I calculated in my head, well, you know, I know we have a couple more years here. In my head, I didn't say that out loud. He said, I don't want your money anymore, but don't stop sending me your notes. And it was a simple statement where the innocence got to come back in my life. And the guilt, like two Christmas elves, just cut them off my shoulders. And we got to have a lot of eyeball-to-eyeball relationship after that point because of the power of the financial amends. I had no idea how tied in I was with that. I had no idea how it made a difference in how I stood around men where I work, men in life, that I carried myself differently around men. There was more of an equality. I didn't even realize it until I would notice it, you know, almost hindsight. I would be in a conference room with the lawyers I work with, and I would realize I have a voice here. I don't have to make myself overdone with them, or I don't have to become the mouse on the wall. I have a voice here, just like everybody else. And it's made a huge difference in my life. And the innocence did come back. I had a lot of, I had a very bad divorce at 10 years of sobriety. And this is where, looking back, I realized that it's God's life that I have the privilege of breathing in and out with. That amends aren't about me. They are for the other person. I mean, much of the time, you know, initially the amends were the people who owed you money. All the bar people were found me. You know, I had to pay them back, you know, before I even started really any step work because they were calling me wanting their money. It's just the way it is. You know, they find you and they want their money, the $50 that you owed them, because they're still drinking. It means a lot. So there were some of those that initially that had to be done. But my husband ended up with a newcomer in the room. It wasn't very pretty. My sponsor, Ginny, smoked some pot in Paris and eventually drank and then came back and had 11, 12 years of sobriety before she passed away on Easter Sunday this year. I had been talking to Clancy because he was Jenny's sponsor. And so when all of that happened in my life, I was 10 years sober and I was a mess. I was a mess. And I remember going to see Clancy and I said, I need some help. And he said, sure. And you know, I think something like, I don't know if you like me, you know, I don't know what's, you know, and he said, well, we'll try. And so we've been trying now for 23 years, and it's been working. And he is louder than my head, and I call him every Tuesday. I know his number by heart. He has not speed dialed in my phone, because if I lose my phone, I want to know my sponsor's number. So if you're doing that, try to know that your sponsor's number, because you never know if you're, when you're going to need it. And I had a really hard time that year, and I remember my car died, and I called my mom and dad like I did on Sunday nights, and we laughed about it. I threw a rod, and it was like, oh, my God, it was a strange experience, and my father shared some of his experience. He always was around heavy equipment. He had a construction excavation business, and so we talked about that because he liked to talk about that kind of thing, and 2 days later, my mom and dad called me, and I had this little baby boy and their grandson, and my dad said, we were with the bankers the other day, and there's this car that he has, and it's got 7,000 miles on it, and we're going to drive it out for you. Now, looking back on that, I see that getting clean with my parents financially freed them up to be mom and dad, to get to be the parents of a daughter having a hard time and helping her out. Now, if I hadn't cleaned up that side of my street, I'm sure my father would have said, well, you know, she took the Studebaker. You know, there was that Cadillac. He didn't even think about it. He went out and found me a car, and they drove it out. It was a It was a Ford Fairlane with deer whistles on the side. If you don't know what deer whistles are, there's these metal things that make noise so that deer run. They can only hear them like dog whistles, but they're deer whistles. And everybody in California went, "What are those?" I said, "It's the bean down the mothership," is what I told them. So that was for them. That was for them. And many of you know that my father, we had a lot of good years. I remember, please work with your sponsor on amends. Don't run home in your first year and rip off scabs and make it all about you and go, "Yeah, you remember this when I, you know, I crashed your car? Do you remember this when, you know, I killed your dog? Do you remember?" You know, it's like there's a way to do it. And my sponsor has walked me, each, whatever sponsor I've had has walked me through it with their experience, strength, and hope. And I remember I was 20 years sober, and I was going back to see my parents, and I said to Clancy, "You know what? I never talked to my father about the day that he had to get on a plane and come find me in a backwards southern Louisiana jail and try to get his daughter out of this jackpot she was in that the carnival, you know, God, don't even mention that around my house, had gotten her into, those carnies, you know. And I said, "Do you think I can ask him about that day now? I really don't remember much about it." And he said, "Yeah, I think so. You're 20 years sober now. They've got, I think you can talk. If the situation comes up, and you can ask him about that." So you know how we are. You know, you go, my dad's out in the dock and out in the lake, and so I go prancing out there, and I go, "Hey, Dad, do you remember the day when, you know, it's like he had to have his checkbook, he had to get on a plane, he had to rent a car, he had to hire a lawyer, he had to get a bail bondsman, he had to go to a backwoods Louisiana town, he had to see his daughter, number two, handcuffed in a mess and had just having DTs and crazy, crazy person. So much so that I remember the moment of seeing my father in that office and feeling the lowest piece of garbage on earth. I hope you have a day you can remember. That's one of my days when I would think about throwing everything away, breaking through everything to go for that bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold. That's one of those days. That's where I get to start, is with that pain and hurting them again. And so my dad said, "Well, yeah, of course I remember that day." You know, he laughed a little bit. And yeah, I said, "I want to know what I said. I don't remember that day. And it's kind of important because it's a low point in my life, and I really want to talk about it." And he says, "Sure." We talked about it. And he said, "The only thing I told him, and this was the truth, I was such a good victim." He said, "All you said was that you weren't guilty and it wasn't your fault." You know, it's like, I mean, sales and possession, but I'm not guilty and it's not my fault. And doesn't matter how much you find on me or what it is. And that was all I said. And so we laughed about that. But I was a victim. I was a victim well into sobriety. At 10 years of sobriety, when I went through that divorce, I became the victim again. At some point of having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I hung up that victim cloak. And occasionally between about 7 years of sobriety when that happened for me and 10 years when my divorce happened, I would put that victim cloak back on briefly. And it would itch, and it was wool, and it was heavy, and it smelled mildewy, and, you know, and I would put it back because I didn't like feeling like a victim because you had given me the sunlight of the Spirit. Now, I'm 10 years sober. My life is over. It's this horrible divorce. It's this newcomer in the room. My sponsor smoked pot. Clancy's my sponsor. I have no idea what's happening in my life. No idea. And this woman that married my husband, pregnant and married in that order, I was getting a little bit of an, resentment, and her baby turned one, and I said to Clancy, "I'm not," they invited us to their party for their baby, and "I'm not going." You know, don't start like that. He said, "Your son wants to go see his brother, put his face in the cake at one, because that's what they do. So he will go, and you will take a present." Oh, you know, he had to add that, take a present. So I hate this girl, right? I hate her. And she's ruined my life, trashed my life. So I go and I get a present, and I find it on sale in the bin at Toys R Us. And But I'm following direction. And I'm in the car to wrap the present. He said, I have to wrap it. So I'm wrinkling up the paper, and then I'm wrapping it. And my son is in his little Ghostbuster suit. Mom, can we go? Mom, can we go? And we go to the door, and he's all excited. And I'm like, I am in the kitchen the whole time. But she was nice to my son, and I saw that she was always nice to my son. And he would get in the car after I'd pick him up at their house, and he would tell me, Jill did this, and Jill did that, and Jill bought me this. And I would, Clancy said, I don't care if your tongue is bleeding, you say nothing about her. And I did that, and I couldn't pray for her, and I hated her, and we started to have to do things with the kids, and I saw how nice she was to my son, and I started to like her little by little. And the one night I was going to throw hot coffee on them and make more, you know, you can't be spiritual with hot coffee. I've heard that somewhere. So I was on my way, and Clancy's always out of town, but he happened to be there that Saturday night, and he took the coffee out of my hands. He put it on the table. He looked me in the eyes. He squared me off with my shoulders, and he said, Sharon, no. I didn't even have to tell him what I was going to do, you know? He said, you're going to walk through this with dignity and grace. And if he would have stopped there, I would have said, I want revenge. I don't care right now about dignity and grace. My life is over. He said, so you can be an example. All right, I heard him. I put the coffee down. I think I gave him up the keys, the extra keys to my ex-husband's car, because I was going to drive it there at low tide one time, but I gave it up. He made me do my inventory again. We went out to Pasadena where he talked and yelled at everybody all the way out there and listened to my inventory coming back. And I did worked up my steps again, and she was on my amends list. Because little did I know that years later, when he left her, she told me she knew she could do it because she had watched me. So I learned it's none of my business what the end result is. I have to keep my side of the street clean. Now, if you want to come sit on my side of the street and I can share my experience, strength, and hope with you. But it talks about my side of the street. And little did I know that, you know, she's one of my best friends today. She gives me a cake every August at my women's meeting. And our kids turned out great. Great kids. We raised our kids. I never forget the time we were at the Wednesday night meeting, and the ex-husband was there. He was both of our exes at the time. And he came up, and we were dressed alike that night, too. It was really strange. And he came up and gave us each an envelope. And I'm looking at my envelope, and she's looking at her envelope, and I'm thinking, am I going to open it up? You know, so we kind of both opened them up. Yours have money? No. Mine? No. It was a moment. It was really a good moment. So my dad got killed on April 19th, 1999, and he had retired from his construction business. He was around heavy equipment his whole life. He went out on a beautiful spring day. He has been retired. He went back to kind of work in his land a little bit. He had come from farming roots. And he was out on a place called the Terraces where there was a little bit of uneven earth, and the tractor went over on him and killed him in a second. And he had walked out of my mother's life that day, gave her a kiss, thanked her for lunch, and never came back. And it was truly an experience that the family came together. And right in the middle of that experience, my family embraced Alcoholics Anonymous. My family embraced the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were already at my house when I got off the plane in Iowa, with making coffee, cleaning the house, getting things ready. I walked up to the church. There was already some flowers from Dick and Peggy there. My sponsor happened to be in South Africa at the time, so I couldn't reach him. And Casey's sponsor, Johnny Harris, came and helped me get on the plane and helped me figure it all out. And Casey was there, and Johnny was there, and my son and I got on the plane. And I was at the church when we had the wake that night. And all day long, I had been wanting to do this for my father. Being the little accordion player girl, his accordion was sitting there. His Czechoslovakian, Heleganka, Mother of Pearl, beautiful inlaid button accordion. Buttons on both sides. I play the piano accordion. I have no idea about a button accordion. But it was sitting there, and it was saying, "You got to play your dad a number." So I picked it up, and I went in the other room, and Kathy, who I sponsor, and I was sat in that room with me all day long as I was trying to play Amazing Grace. And then, you know, the buttons would go one way, the buttons would go another way. It wasn't like the piano, and I can do that still to this day. So I worked and worked hours, and I would, you know, poor Kathy was like in a coma. "Yeah, that's better. That's a lot better." And so I was at the wake, and something hit me. I was, again, the middle child with the resentments, and everybody thought I was my sister, and nobody knew my name, and this is my hometown, and there's 400 people here, but nobody cares who I am again, and my father is laid out in a casket. I mean, closed casket, but he's up there. It's my dad's wake, and I am worried about me. So I thought, I better call and see if Clancy's back. So I went to the office of the rectory, and I called him, and I said, you know, nobody... I'm on hold. He didn't answer. Midnight mission, I'm on hold. So I hung up. I call back. I said, to the guy answering the phone, I said, "Tell Clancy it's Sharon. He's got 60 seconds to get on the phone." I was like, it's all about me now. And he picked up at about 48. And he said, "You know, Sharon, I'm so glad you called. I'm so sorry. I'm just back. And I heard what happened. And I know." And he was very compassionate. And then I launch into me. You know, I've been working all day on this number, and I don't think I can play it, and they all think I'm Nancy, and, you know, just blah, blah, blah. And he's, you know, he's listening because I'm kind of, you know, I'm in an emotional state here, and he's listening. And then he says, "Sharon, okay, listen, you're going to be terrific. You're going to play that Amazing Grace for your father. It'll be great. Everybody in that church, there won't be a dry eye. But I want you to look around that church and really look at the people sobbing, because those are the musicians." And once again, we connect with our humor. We connect with our laughter. We connect with what it's all about. I mean, it's a joke, you know. It's just, I can't believe I can get back into self-centeredness so, so easily. And I'm so, so glad that I know to pick up the phone before I make things wrong again, because I know that I've made a lot of amends in sobriety. I've made amends for things that have just happened. I've made amends for things that were last week. I've had to. I mean, I'm a work in progress here. And the one thing I've learned is to eat the crow while it's still warm, because it tastes better. And cold crow tastes really bad. So I've learned how, you know, and I can't sit well. The sunlight of the Spirit, what blocks me from the sunlight of the Spirit, it's been talked about this week, and I like being a seeker. I'm a seeker. I want more of that. At 7 years, I stood up and got tip of my head to tip of my toes, God's kid, something happened to me. It was like, wow. And I'm going to keep seeking that. I like that. That's the joy of living. I want to tell you about the carnival, and then I'm getting pretty done. I've got lots of other amends stories, but I never thought there'd be any way that I could make amends for the carnival. I mean, I joined when I was an organic farmer in northern Wisconsin. That's another long story, but... I end up in this carnival, Matt Armstrong shows. I'm a shooting gallery girl. I called my mother. She started to cry. I can't talk to my dad. Now I can't talk to my mom. She cries when I call home. So it was better to not call home. And after that point in my life of ripping and roaring and being the tornado, I had another 4 years of drinking. And so I was not very nice. You know, I had been on this mellow place with these organic people, just smoking and drinking organic stuff. It was like, oh, and they didn't like to, you know, they didn't like to drink tequila and kick the goose or something. It was just, you know, they didn't let it out. They just were too mellow all the time. So by the time I found this carnival, and I took my crop with me. That's what got me in trouble in Louisiana. I was cowboy boots on, you know, every four-letter word that there was out of my mouth all the time. We all had aliases, and, you know, I had a dog, and let's go, and my nice dog started turning mean and baring her teeth at people, and, you know, she was sweet, and now she turned into this, just like me, this mean person, and I would pull out my joint wherever we were and, you know, hang my flash and set it up and, you know, start calling, barking people in, and, you know, it was like, three shots for a quarter or something. It was, you know, and these kids would all line up and they'd want to win that teddy bear. They'd want to win that thing over there. And I'd pull them all in and I'd think, none of you guys are winning tonight, you know. Go ahead and try, you know. And my dog would bare her teeth and, you know, the kids would run away. And it's like, that lady's mean. And, you know, I had just turned into this mean person, and I was ripping people off and loving every minute of it, you know, because you're in town and then you're out of town. You're in town maybe 3 days, and I had no idea that all that was going to catch up with me someday. So how do you make amends for ripping off kids with the carnival? It was really pretty sad. And I, my son was 5 and was asked to leave the school because he already had a rap sheet, and at 5, and I called Clarence. I said, they're kicking him out of the Lutheran school. What do I do? And he said, take him to Sheila. I said, Sister Sheila? Yeah, Sheila, who you sponsor. You know, she was principal of a Catholic school. And I was like, but I sponsor her. Take him to Sheila. All right. So I called Sheila. I said, yeah, because I sponsor this nun, which is a long story. But, and she said, bring him over. So I brought him over, and my son went through 8th grade there. And he shaped up and liked the structure. Who would have thunk it? And did very well. And he's doing very well in his life today. So he's a good, passionate, compassionate child, right? And doesn't seem to have the disease. And Casey and he and I live all in the same roof, and it's really a good life. But so he went there, and guess what they have every year to make money? Those Catholics have a school carnival every spring. Every spring. And it's 3 days long, and it's a lot of work, and guess who volunteered? So I worked that school carnival from kindergarten up through 8th grade, and I bought the ride tickets for the kids. My son's little band of, you know, brothers got bigger every year. Yeah, Wesley's mom's buying tickets, you know, so every year, and I think they were all like 12 of them standing around me the last year that I'm buying tickets for. And I worked, and I counted money, and I was there, and I was of service. And when that, they, you know, when the last light went out and the last joint was taken down after that 8th grade year of my son, I thought, okay, I think it's over now. It felt good. And also part of that process was making amends to the Catholic Church. I had no idea that I had such a chip on my shoulder about God. I had had a big fight with God in American Martyrs Church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I got that priest so mad at me, he came out of the confessional. And then I could look at him and call him the hypocrite, because that's what I was good at. And I left God there, and I didn't want God to know where I was. And the process of the steps and opening up my heart and doing a lot of action. This is, amends are action steps. It is laid out specifically. There are specifics for everything. It says 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens. Oh, I like those odds. I really like those odds. You know, because of all of that, I found out God goes in the Catholic Church too, that they talk about peace and love. And I was able to, you know, once again, open up my world so that I don't have to look over my shoulder at anybody or anything. That, you know, Jimmy Ryan used to say, willingness without action is fantasy. And these two steps are very much action-oriented steps. I can sit back and think about it before I go to sleep, but if I do nothing about it, I don't reap the rewards, and the rewards are in the promises. And, you know, there's a lot of promises in the book, but Steve said it last night. It said, if, you know, there's a condition, if we are painstaking. And, you know, the promises themselves are, I can't see a thing up here, so, but they have brought me the freedom. They have brought me the innocence. They have brought me intuition. They have given me a purpose in life. This process of amends have given me my purpose, which every morning I recite on page 77, because it gives me the freedom to be God's kid. It gives me the freedom to have the innocence in my life. It gives me the freedom to be able to make mistakes, tell on myself, ask what I need to do about it, pray about it, write about it, whatever it's needed to be done, go to a sponsor about it, and then take the appropriate action so that I get to live on the sunny side of the street. And I am one of those drinkers that drinks in dark, cold bars with the windows painted black. That's the way my soul was when I came to you. And I live in a home where the door is open and the phone is ringing, and I love a man called Casey who is my husband now for 2 years. My son got to walk me down the aisle 2 years ago. My father wasn't there, but he was in my heart, because between me and Dad, there was nothing but love. There was not that what if. And you've given me that. You've given me the freedom to walk down the sunny side of the street with my head up. And I had no idea. I had no idea when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on August 20th, 1975, that I was going to have a brand new life, a brand new spirit, a brand new purpose, a host of friends. I always looked for the mothership. I was one of the little girls and sitting in the soybean field going, it's Iowa, come get me. And you left me off too soon, you know. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in my very first meeting. The man that talked, I don't remember much of anything else, but he said from the podium, that little spark, he just blew on that little spark. He said he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. Oh, God, a spaceship guy. That little ember of life that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous got fanned. And that's what you've done for me. My fire roars today. If you need a log, come get it. We've been talking a lot about dogs, and I was having lunch with the white boys, and we were talking about cats. And they're not cat-friendly people, but that's okay. You know, cats need attendance. That's kind of the way it is, you know. But I have this cat, and he's about 15 pounds of rescue. He's been rescued. He was a kitten, and he's grown up, and you can hear him walk across the floor. He's so big, thump, thump, thump. And he sleeps on his back in the middle of the floor. And my dog, he thinks the dog's the mother. He suckled on her when he was little. I mean, just have no idea. This is cat. But you walk in my house, he's gone. You never see him. Gone, 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 gone. He's the biggest chicken. Until he gets to know you, it takes a long time. But in the morning, my dog is very polite. She does her thing. She sits. She waits for her fish oil. I throw in the air. She catches it. It's the only way I can get her to eat it. And then we have her food. And then we have the other cat. Casey's cat gets fed. And then Taz, the big cat, is whining like you wouldn't believe. It's like he's, you know, he's 15 pounds, never missed a meal. But whine, 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 all around my legs, and please feed me, oh my God, don't forget, I'm hungry, you know, and he's going on and on and on, and it's like, geez, cat, you know, I can't even walk, he's all around me. And one morning I was feeding this big macho cat, and I thought, oh my God, look at this, this is me and God. God, please, I need something, don't forget me, I'm hungry, you know, it's just like so undignified, and... So I'm going to be like my dog, wait for my fish oil, you know. And but I love my animals. I have whole thing about animals and making amends to the animal kingdom and rescuing them and all of that, because I went through a lot of pain and heartache with my animals when I was drinking and losing them. But I like to remember what Mary Regan always said, and it's very true. It's just, God, please help me to become half the person that my dog thinks I am. So what you have done with me is you have given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. You have given me the actions by which I can hold my head up, be God's kid, feel the innocence of the sunlight on my spirit, and walk with you. And I want to thank you for that. Thank you.